Good afternoon, everyone. Salem, about 3 months ago, I guess it was March 11th, 2017, I've got it here, I gave part one of a split sermon. Today is part two. Exiles in Babylon, Lessons from Daniel, part two. That's my title here. Part one, we read through the first two chapters of the book of Daniel and began looking at Daniel from the standpoint of a man who lived almost his entire life as an exile in a very foreign culture, a culture that was opposed to God, a culture that served a false god, and a culture that was described as one of extravagance and wicked luxury. And then we noticed how he conducted himself within that culture. And from that standpoint, I presented 10 short lessons, mini lessons that we could apply today as we, like Daniel, find ourselves living in a culture that is becoming increasingly foreign to us and increasingly hostile to godly values. I had a reminder of this 3, 4, or 5 weeks ago, substitute teaching. I was called to sub from one class into an art class, and I'm walking down the hall. It's kind of in between classes. It was passing time, and I was walking behind a girl with a real tall, thin girl, and wearing, despite the fact she was very tall, wearing high-heeled shoes, a black, slinky, lacy dress, and long pinkish blonde hair, kind of striking looking. And I thought, wow, I don't think I'd seen her before. Just saw her from the back. Well, went into the art class, and I had a substitute in the art class, and so I go in, and usually I have to call roll because I don't know the kids necessarily all by sight, so I'm calling down the roll list and seeing who's here and who's not. And I get done, and I'm still kind of looking down at the roll book and feel the presence of a student next to me. And you didn't call my name. And I look up, and I kind of do a double take, and it's this girl, except you didn't call my name, you know, that, and you're a dude. I didn't say that, but the girl that I saw was not a girl. That was a guy, just a tall, thin guy. And I did go into the, actually, well, maybe I'm wrong, but I went into the computer system and typed in the name and later on. And yeah, that's a male, all right. But evidently he didn't go by that name that I had called. He went by a more feminine name. And okay. That's a strangeness. I mean, we've heard about it, but when you get confronted with it like that, and I had to think, actually, that was one of the more striking examples. I can think of, I think, 7 or 8 different students at the school there that I know view themselves as a gender different than what they really are. They all seem to get along with me fairly well. One of them, in fact, she, the way she was born anyway, doesn't consider herself, well, sometimes she considers herself a boy, but sometimes she tells me, no, I'm an it today. I'm neither a boy nor a girl. It's strangeness. I did find out, too, this surprised me, but apparently the tall, thin guy that dressed like a girl, he is allowed to use the girls' restroom at the school. And that kind of surprised me. And there was one other student, one other girl who was allowed to use the boys' restroom until they found her, I guess, kissing or making out with her boyfriend in the boys' bathroom. And so, I don't know, there's something weird going on there. So, but anyway, apparently that's allowed, which I had heard there were some directives about that, but I didn't know it had actually taken place. Anyway, I'm getting a little off track here, but yeah, things are not the same as I remember growing up in the 50s and the 60s. Today we're going to go through chapter 3 of Daniel, and I'll present 7 additional lessons to the 10 that I gave last time. Again, kind of mini lessons. You can begin turning to the book of Daniel, and as you do, we'll recall that Babylon was ruled by Nebuchadnezzar, who during a significant portion of his 43-year reign, could have been a couple of years actually reigning with his father, but during that time he was arrogant, he was egotistical. He had inherited tremendous wealth. He gained control of vast amounts of real estate. And he prided himself in his building accomplishments and making Babylon great. He also made a lot of rash pronouncements without thinking things through very well. And so, you see, maybe in some ways, Babylon's a little different from our country today. In fact, I don't think they had to deal with the gender issues that we do, but there are some other things that make Babylon at that time seem similar to what we're facing today. We'll also review some of the significant facts from chapter 2, in which Daniel tells and interprets Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the great image of which he, Nebuchadnezzar, was the head. So from the last part of chapter 2, verse 31, "You, O king," Daniel speaking here, "were watching and behold a great image. This great image whose splendor was excellent stood before you and its form was awesome. The image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly iron and partly clay." So we notice increasingly sort of inferior materials being used here describing the image as it works its way down. "You watched while a stone was cut without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found, and the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold." Probably didn't emphasize it that much in my previous message, but we can notice that it is God who put Nebuchadnezzar in his position as ruler. And it seems as general, God gives nations, or at least allows nations, to have the quality of leadership that the people in those nations in general deserve. Verse 39, "But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all others. Whereas you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with the ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay." So we've had head of gold, but the rest, kind of inferior materials. Verse 44, "And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." So we see the prophecies of world-dominating empires leading up to the establishment of God's kingdom. It's not my intent to elaborate on those prophecies today. But Daniel had miraculously told Nebuchadnezzar not only what his dream was, but also its interpretation. And Nebuchadnezzar was so amazed that verse 46 and 47, you know, he fell down before Daniel, he proclaimed, "Truly, your God is the God of gods." He appears to have been humbled, at least somewhat. So now we're ready for chapter 3. Now, according to some sources, the events of chapter 3 occur during the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, after Daniel and his friends had been in Babylon for about 20 years. So this might be 18 years after the events of chapter 2. Some historians set the time at about 586 B.C. So chapter 3, verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, maybe 90 feet, and its width 6 cubits. He set it in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. I've kind of wondered, now, was this a statue? Well, if it was 6 cubits wide and 60 high, that's a 10-to-1 ratio, and it seems like that would be kind of a skinny statue. So was it an obelisk? I don't know. Before church today, I thought, yeah, was that too skinny to be a statue? I took out a tape measure, and I think my shoulders are like 1.5 feet, and I'm a little under 6 feet. So I figure that's a 1-to-4 ratio. So, and I'm not real wide. I'm kind of skinny. So a 1-to-10 ratio, that'd be real skinny if it was a statue. And I don't know what it was, and I haven't read anything, but it seems like maybe it was just sort of an obelisk. But anyway, at least it was another massive building project, a towering project, and it was dedicated to Nebuchadnezzar's greatness. Notice, though, that Nebuchadnezzar had the entire image made of gold, as opposed to the image of his dream that he had years earlier, which only the head was gold. Of course, he was that head, and the rest was made of inferior materials. So we wonder, some speculation here, has Nebuchadnezzar forgotten the lesson from the dream of 18 years ago? Is he at least symbolically and maybe arrogantly trying to defy God's message? Here's a whole image made of gold. Is he saying, yeah, this is entirely gold. My kingdom's not going to be replaced by one of inferior quality. Anyway, verse 2. King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, counselors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the satraps, administrators, governors, counselors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." You can notice in verse 4 that the decree was commanded. And in verse 6, that the incentive to obey the command was to avoid being thrown in the fiery furnace. It seems like an absolutely kind of absurd directive for a leader who at one time proclaimed to acknowledge the true God. We can extrapolate a warning lesson for us from this. It's a slight variation, I guess, of lesson number 3 from part 1 that I gave. I call this lesson number 11, if you're carrying on from part 1. So lesson 11, be prepared to deal with ungodly directives, even from leaders who proclaim to acknowledge God. Be prepared to deal with ungodly directives, even from leaders who claim to acknowledge God, especially if they're arrogant and lack humility. Leaders who claim to be Christian won't necessarily rule that way. I think we can think of a fairly recent past. Barack Obama claimed to be Christian, but he directed the Department of Justice not to enforce the Defense of Marriage Act. In fact, he kind of paved the way for same-sex marriage. He defended Planned Parenthood, abortion rights. He sent out the directive that I didn't realize had reached our school, but about allowing people who consider themselves of one gender to be able to use the restroom, well, of the gender that they're not, basically. So, strange directives. So don't necessarily trust government leaders or business leaders who merely say they honor God. Over the past few years, my wife has worked for two different bosses. Go back about 4 or 5 years. And these, one boss was a Buddhist, and the other was a professing Christian. And guess which one was easier to work with? It was the Buddhist. Yeah. Her Christian boss was unkind. He showed no concern for those working under him. He made unreasonable edicts. One of her coworkers said, "Yeah, he's got a leadership style, all right. It's leadership by intimidation." And yet he called himself a Christian. He gave Christians a bad name. And it leads to sort of a corollary lesson here. I didn't really enumerate it as such. But it's a reminder to us that if we profess to be Christians, we take on the name of Christ, and we better act like Christians. If we act in an unchristian manner, we're essentially taking God's name in vain. We're breaking the third commandment. Well, the verses also give us an example of Nebuchadnezzar's leadership style, and it's an opportunity to contrast the two, godly leadership. And this is my lesson number 12. Godly leaders do not lead by intimidation. We could refer to Matthew 20 and be reminded of what Jesus says about godly leadership and being in a position to rule over others. Matthew 20. Verses 25-26. I quickly read through those. Verse 25, Jesus called them to himself, called his disciples to him. And he said, "You know the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant." Godly leadership begins with an attitude of service. Nebuchadnezzar obviously was showing the opposite attitude. He wanted to be worshipped. He wanted to be served rather than to serve. And to get compliance from his subjects, he used threats and intimidation. Good leader strives to inspire others. It sets a good example and inspires others to get things done, tries not to intimidate them. And it's a lesson for us as parents and perhaps even grandparents. Wouldn't necessarily need to turn there. I'm going to refer to Colossians 3:21, where Paul says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged." And in Ephesians, Paul writes, Ephesians 6:4, "Fathers, again, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord." Train, teach, talk, instruct, don't use a Nebuchadnezzar type attitude, do it or else. Instead, explain why it's important to obey instruction. Yes, I suppose a parent may need to enforce consequences at times for disobedience. There may be a time for the rod of correction, but only after there's been real teaching and instruction. Back to Daniel 3 and verse 7. So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Lesson number 13. Intimidation often results in herd mentality and people doing things that they would not otherwise do. There's probably an easier way to state that, but I couldn't come up with it. Intimidation often results in herd mentality and people doing things they would not otherwise do. We could consider Hitler's Germany. You know, don't be intimidated and get sucked into following the masses who are following a crazy leader. Figure there must have been at least a few people who must have thought, now this is really a kind of a stupid directive and bowing down and worshiping a golden image. But everybody else is doing it, and so I guess I'll do it too. And besides that, I don't want to get thrown in the oven. So we see some of this today. You know, this is a really dumb thing to do, a dumb thing to say, a dumb directive, but everybody else is complying, and well, I don't want to lose my job over it, so I guess I'll comply as well. It takes real courage to resist intimidation and stand up to peer pressure. Verse 8, therefore at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Well, there are certain Jews among you, or certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O God, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your guards or worship the golden image which you have set up. They're not following your directives. So we have some tattletales come forward, and perhaps they're motivated maybe by jealousy, maybe by envy, because of the high government positions that were held by Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they accuse them. Lesson number 14. God's people can expect to face intolerant enemies and accusers. And we've already seen that. I don't know if we've experienced it personally here, but we've certainly seen it with people who are standing up to some of the directives about involving same-sex marriage and the like. Even though there may be no logical reason for it, other than jealousy, envy, or just the fact that we're Christians, some people want to see us punished for our beliefs and will want to see us punished. Beliefs that are contrary to theirs. On sort of a side note here, what about Daniel? You know, they accused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They didn't accuse Daniel. Why wasn't he accused along with his friends? I don't really know. I've heard four possibilities. Number one, he might not have been there, although verse 3 seems to indicate that all the high-level government officials were in attendance. Number two, maybe he was standing in a position or a location that nobody happened to notice that he didn't bow down. seems legitimate. Number three, maybe Daniel's would-be accusers thought Daniel was so highly ranked, and that is a close advisor to the king, they didn't want to risk irritating Nebuchadnezzar in case Nebuchadnezzar was willing to let Daniel be an exception to the directive. Or number four, maybe Daniel had a moment of weakness and maybe he actually bowed down before the image. We don't know. Maybe gave into intimidation and peer pressure. Even if he did, though, we know he redeemed himself. He did pass the test later on. He was able to pass the test of being willing to submit himself to the lion's den. But kind of wondered about that at times. Verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image that I have set up? Now, if you're ready at that time to hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery in symphony with all kinds of music. Notice the repetition there, kind of another side note. I think that's the fourth time that phrase is used here. And you fall down and worship the image which I have made. Well, good. In other words, I'll give you one more chance. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Shadrach, and Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. Our minds are made up. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Lesson number 15. God's true followers must be prepared to put their lives on the line. God's true followers must be prepared to put their lives on the line. We have to be prepared to accept the worst. We know that martyrdom occurred in the past, and it's prophesied for some of God's servants in the future. We can take comfort, though, in the fact that we are promised to never be subjected to more than what we can bear. But we need to determine ahead of time to stand firm in the faith, no matter what the consequences. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were willing to die rather than break the second commandment. They would not conform to what everybody else was doing or being told to do. Today, I don't think too many of us have had to literally put our lives on the line. However, many of us, I think, have had to put our means of livelihood on the line. We have had to put our jobs on the line at times because of the Sabbath or the holy days. And it could be other issues now coming up where we're going to have to face difficult consequences. Even our young people get tested. There'd be a lot of pressure to compromise, especially those of our young people in the public schools, especially on Friday night with Friday night or Saturday activities, especially involving extracurricular activities. Think of even the last decade or so, two of our graduating high school seniors who attended Salem Church, and I guess they visited with us last week. They were they had to confront this. Their graduation from high school overlapped. I think it was on the Sabbath, and I think it even overlapped with church services. And they were scheduled to receive a number of awards at their graduation. at the ceremony as well, and they were conflicted. But in the end, I guess they decided, well, I guess it's more important, higher priority to go to church than it is to and observe the Sabbath than to go to our graduation. And they missed it. I think my son thought he was facing the same consequences, though it was a Friday night graduation. And okay, well, when is sundown? When does the graduation ceremony get over with? And I think he thought, well, it might overlap a little, so there's a good excuse not to go to graduation. I don't think he wanted to go. My daughters did, though, and yeah, the ceremony ended well before sundown. Going on to verse 19. Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it's usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. And he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did you not cast 3 men bound in the midst of the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." "Well, look," he answered, "I see 4 men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the 4th is like the Son of God." Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire, and the satraps, administrators, governors, and king's counselors gathered together. And they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of the fire was not on them. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be God, the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies. They should not serve nor worship any god except their own God." Their actions impressed Nebuchadnezzar. So now 18 years later, Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges God for the second time. And it appears God is again working with Nebuchadnezzar and giving an opportunity to gain just a little bit more understanding. Verse 29. "Therefore I," Nebuchadnezzar here speaking again, "therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or language that speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there's no other God who can deliver like this." Well, okay, so he still doesn't have all of the understanding that God wants him to have yet. That seems a little hypocritical, Nebuchadnezzar, to deal so harshly with his subjects when God has dealt rather patiently with him. And perhaps there's another lesson for us. I didn't have this enumerated as one of them, so I guess I'll call it lesson 15 and a half. Nebuchadnezzar shows us that there's a difference between actually acknowledging God and actually acting in a godly manner. The difference between acknowledging God and acting godly. Verse 30. "Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon." And we finish chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar had begun to change. The change at this stage is still minimal. However, it still brings us to the next lesson, lesson 16. God can change the heart of a ruler. Of course, we remember the story of the Exodus and God changing the heart of Pharaoh. But God can change the heart of a ruler. It won't be as apparent until the end of the next chapter, though, of how he's changed Nebuchadnezzar. But when it benefits his people or helps him carry out his purpose, God can humble the most ruthless, arrogant leaders. And Nebuchadnezzar was. He was ruthless. He was callous. He was arrogant. Some other passages we find he was very cruel. He put out the eyes of King Zedekiah just after he had executed Zedekiah's sons. He wanted that to be the last thing Zedekiah saw. Yet God sent Nebuchadnezzar dreams. He performed amazing miracles before him in order to get his attention, and he began to change Nebuchadnezzar's attitude. I'm going to turn to 1 Timothy 2, and we'll tie this in with some New Testament instruction. This will lead up to my last point here. 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 through 4. We'll hear from the Apostle Paul. I'll go on to some of Peter's comments eventually, too. But from Paul, 1 Timothy 2, verse 1. Therefore, I exhort, first of all, that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings, and all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. Okay, now I want to take a look at what Peter says. 1 Peter 2, verses 13 to 17. First Peter 2, verse 13. Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme. Well, submit as long as the ordinance doesn't conflict with the laws of God, like Nebuchadnezzar's directive conflicted with the law of God. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme, or verse 14 here, or to governors as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, for the praise of those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. And certainly the doing good that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did, they changed Nebuchadnezzar's outlook for a little bit. Verse 16, as free, yet not using liberty as a cloak for vice, but as bondservants of God, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. And at this time, Peter's writing this, Nero was the emperor of Rome, and Nero was a pretty bad guy. He was pretty evil. Yet Paul says, honor him. Lesson 17, last one today. Pray for our nation's leaders. Pray for our nation's leaders. Pray that God will give us the type of leaders or influence the leaders that we do have, so that we are able to live peaceably and can freely continue to do the work of preparing a spiritual family and proclaiming the gospel message of the coming kingdom of Jesus. Brethren, we live in strange times in what's becoming a very strange country. if God can use Daniel and his friends as exiles in a strange land at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, he can use us in the times of Donald Trump or whoever the nation's leaders happen to be. Be prepared for the challenges ahead. Remember the lessons from Daniel. The challenges will come, but God will see us through those challenges, and he'll use us to further his work.